Hello, everybody. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in Genesis chapter 44. I'm going to do the whole chapter in this audio, verses 1 through 34. We'll entitle this chapter, Joseph Test His Brothers. This is when his brothers came down for their second visit to Egypt. Our context is this. In the previous chapter, chapter 43, the brothers had come down for their first visit to Egypt. So now we start in Genesis 44, verse 1. Actually, we'll do verses 1 and 2. Then he commanded, that's Joseph, commanded his house steward, saying, fill the men's sacks with food as much as they can carry, and put each man's money in the mouth of his sack. Put my cup, the silver cup, in the mouth of the sack of the youngest, and his money for the grain. And the steward did as Joseph had told him. Now, Joseph said, fill the sacks of grain with as much as they could carry. A lot, because Joseph is worried about his family in Egypt. He wants them to have as much grain as possible. He said, put each man's money in the mouth of his sack. This replicates what he had done when the brothers returned from their first visit to Egypt. It's the same action, but it's different money. In fact, I need to go through the transactions here that happened with the money, a chronology of events concerning the money. First of all, on the first trip, the brothers paid the Egyptian officials for the grain, and the steward acknowledged receipt of that money, as we know from Genesis 43:23. This is when the brothers had come back the second time, getting ready to eat that banquet in Joseph's house, and the steward said, be at ease, do not be afraid. Your God and the God of your father has given you treasure in your sacks. I had your money. In other words, if God gave you that money, I had receipt for the money that you paid for the grain. You are not a thief. Now, still on the brothers' first trip, Joseph puts an equivalent amount of money in the 9 sacks of his brethren at the end of their first Egyptian visit. And, of course, on the lodging place on the way back to Canaan, they opened the sacks up and discovered the money that was there. So they go back to Canaan. Jacob finds out about the money in the sacks. And so he says, okay, take that money back and then take another amount, a double amount, so you can give the money back that you got in the 9 sacks after your first trip, and then you can buy some more grain on your second trip. So the brothers come back on their second trip, and we'll assume here they paid for the 11 sacks of grain. Now it's 11 instead of 9 because they got 2 more brothers, Simeon, who before had been held in prison as surety in Egypt, so he didn't go back with a sack. And then Benjamin now, who wasn't involved in the first trip at all, now he's got a sack. So there's 11 sacks now, and their brothers pay for those 11 sacks of grain on the second trip to Egypt. And they pay that from the extra amount of money that Jacob had sent. And then the brothers return what I call the 9 sack reimbursement money, the money they had gotten on their first trip, which Joseph had secretly put in their sacks. The brothers return that money. We know that from the next chapter in Genesis 44:8, the brothers say, we even brought back to you, Joseph, from the land of Canaan, the silver we found at the top of our bags. How could we steal silver or gold from your master's house? So they've returned that money. And so now they're even, but then on their way back, we'll see here in a minute in this chapter, Joseph puts money in the 11 sacks on their way back after their second visit. And so now they're up 11 sacks worth of money at the end of the second visit. But now, in these 11 sacks, there was something special added. That was the silver cup that Joseph had put in Benjamin's sack. Now, we will talk in just a minute in order to discuss why Joseph put that silver cup in Benjamin's sack. But first of all, we need to ask, why did Joseph put all the money in the 11 sacks of his brothers? Why did he do that? Jameson Fawcett and Brown said, perhaps it's to show affection for Jacob. One more sack of money for Jacob? I don't really think so. Think the better reason, according to Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown, is to prevent the brothers from suspecting Benjamin of creating a theft. If the brothers looked in Benjamin's bag and saw that Benjamin had money but the brothers had no money in their bag, what are they going to think? They're going to say, aha, Benjamin, you're a thief, and you're going to get us all killed. But now that all the brothers had money in their sacks, they all looked equally guilty. And so now Joseph, having contrived a situation where all the brothers are equally guilty, the brothers can look at an innocent Benjamin, or equally innocent. Actually, the brothers would think they were equally innocent, not guilty. They looked guilty, but they knew they were innocent, and they would think that Benjamin was innocent. And now Joseph could see how his brothers would act toward an innocent Benjamin, an innocent younger brother, to see if they would act any differently than how they acted toward an innocent Joseph in Jothan some 22, 23, 24, 25 years earlier. to see if they've changed any. I think that's probably what was going on here. Now, note that the purpose of the original money that was sent back at the end of the first Egyptian journey in the 9 sacks, that was to make the brothers look like thieves. Now, why did Joseph want to make his brothers look like thieves? So they would have plenty of incentive to bring Benjamin back in order to prove their honesty, to prove that they weren't thieves, and also to prove that they weren't spies, which Joseph accused them of. Bringing back Benjamin as surety would corroborate the original story, and Joseph wanted to get Benjamin back. He wanted to see if those brothers, having power over Benjamin, would treat him right. Now, there's something we need to think about here, too. What if they had not treated Benjamin right? Joseph could be putting Benjamin in a little bit of trouble here if his brothers were still the murdering brothers that they were before. I suspect Joseph all along, if he'd have suspected that they were going to do anything to Benjamin, once he got Benjamin back into Egypt, he would protect the brothers. He would protect Benjamin in any way he could just by threatening the brothers. So I don't think Benjamin was in a lot of trouble. And besides, Joseph protected him here by making all the brothers look guilty, not just Benjamin. And so Benjamin was not in any danger of being turned over to the Egyptians so that the innocent brothers could go, because if they turned Benjamin over, they'd have to turn themselves over because they were all equally guilty. They all had money in their sack. Now, that's why the money was in the 11 sacks. Now, why was the silver cup in Benjamin's sack? Here's a couple of options, several. First option from John and Gill and Jameson Fawcett and Brown, that they suggest that maybe Joseph wanted to put Benjamin in apparent danger in order to see how his brothers would react to the favoritism shown to Benjamin. Now, I just finished saying the money being in all the sacks showed that they were all in it together, but the silver cup made Benjamin stand out a little bit worse, so that he was favored. Well, the brothers hadn't reacted well to Jacob's favoritism with Joseph. Now maybe Joseph can see how the brothers will react when they see Benjamin is favored. Another option as to why that cup was put into Benjamin's sack was that Joseph did it in order to stress the brothers, as Adam Clark suggests. This would make the brothers' discovery of Joseph's identity to have much greater effect when they realized that they weren't going to be in trouble for stealing a silver cup from the Pharaoh's official, but they were going to be reunited with their brother. Stealing a silver cup would really be a major crime. I don't think Clark is right here. I don't think Joseph would willy-nilly stress his brothers just for the sake of making them feel better when the stress was relieved. I think he was just trying to show favoritism to Benjamin to see how they would react toward that favoritism. We go now to Genesis 44, verses 3 through 5. As soon as it was light, the men, that's the brothers, were sent away, they with their donkeys. They had just gone out of the city, and were not far off when Joseph said to his house steward, "Up, follow the men, and when you overtake them, say to them, 'Why have you repaid evil for good? Is not this the one from which my Lord drinks, and which he indeed uses for divination? You have done wrong in doing this. Why have you repaid evil for good?'" In other words, I gave you a big banquet, treated you kindly, and now you're stealing from me. Now, these men, when they set off, they were probably in a very good mood after the warm welcome they had received. They feasted in the house of Pharaoh's number two man. Oh, they're feeling great. They'd just gotten out of the city, and what city this is unknown. Some people have suggested Memphis, which is about 13 miles south of modern Cairo, which is where the city of On, Heliopolis, as the Greeks called On, was, or maybe a little further to the northeast in the eastern delta region at Zoan. But as I've said in previous audios, nobody knows. The NIV Study Bible says the city is unknown. People debate that. Doesn't matter. They had just gotten out of the city. Then Joseph said, "Oh, go catch up with them." Now, Joseph probably had gotten up early to observe when the brothers left, as John Gill says. He probably had the steward ready with horses ready to go. He probably guessed how far the brothers would have gone, so the steward would know where to go to catch up with them. And there's probably only one road there through northeastern Egypt, through the land of Goshen. So that's no problem for the steward to catch up with the brothers. Now, he tells the steward to accuse the brothers, and to mention in particular silver cup, and to identify the silver cup as the one from which my Lord, that's Joseph, drinks, and the silver cup which he, Joseph, uses for divination. Joseph using a cup for divination? Now that has caused commentators some problems, because Joseph was a man of God. He would never do divination, because divination is of the devil. He's seeking familiar spirits, demonic spirits, in order to do tricks and to know the future and so forth. Why would Joseph do that? Well, here's some optional solutions. One, the steward said this on his own to scare the brothers. He mentioned that divination cup. But the problem here in the verse, it says Joseph is telling the steward what to say. The steward's not just saying this. Joseph is instructing the steward what to say. And Joseph says to mention my cup of divination. So that's not the answer. Here's the answer, in my humble opinion. Joseph told the steward to tell the brothers in order to scare them. He didn't actually use the cup to divine the future. He just pretended to. It was all a part of the ruse to deceive the brothers, as Adam Clark and John Gill says. So I believe that's the correct option. Here's a third option. The word divination means to try. And John Gill quotes the Arabic version of the scripture, and indeed he hath tried you by it. In other words, the cup that he used to test the brothers to see whether they were thieves or not. And how did Joseph test to see whether the brothers were thieves or not? To see whether they would return the cup. So it would read this way. The steward should say, according to Joseph's instructions, is not this the one from which my Lord drinks and which he is using to test you with? Well, that's a nice solution. But Adam Clark doesn't buy it. Here's what he says. Quote, divination by cups has been from time immemorial prevalent among the Asiatics. And for want of knowing this, commentators have spent a profusion of learned labor upon these words in order to reduce them to that kind of meaning which would at once be consistent with the scope and design of the history and save Joseph from the impeachment of sorcery and divination. Well, I don't know why commentators have spent so much time trying to rescue Joseph's reputation. Everybody uses cups for divination. He just said Joseph wasn't using that cup to divine things with. He probably drank from it, and he just probably set up. I mean, the whole thing is a ruse. I mean, if you think about it, Joseph's lying to his brothers constantly. That's an interesting, just thought of something for ethical discussion about, is it okay to lie? Joseph was lying all over the place here, but we won't get into that. He was just using that cup as a part of his scheme in order to test the brothers. So the last thing the steward is supposed to say to the brothers when he discovers that cup in Benjamin's bag, the steward is supposed to say, you have done wrong, brothers, in doing this. Well, John Gill says, wrong is sort of an understatement. They not only did wrong, but that what they did was mad. It was insane. It was crazy to steal from a priest who just honored you. And you can imagine what those brothers felt when they saw that silver cup. We go now to Genesis 44, verses 6 through 10. So he, that's the steward, overtook the 11 brothers, and spoke these words to them. They said to him, why does my Lord speak such words as these? Far be it from your servants to do such a thing. Behold, the money which we found in the mouth of our sacks we have brought back to you from the land of Canaan. How then could we steal silver or gold from your Lord's house? With whomever of your servants it is found, let him die, and we also will be my Lord's slaves. The my Lord there is talking about Joseph. So he, the steward, said, now let it also be according to your words. He with whom it is found shall be my slave, and the rest of you shall be innocent. Now in verse 6, we see the steward overtaking the brothers. How did he do that? Well, I've already mentioned how they already had this whole thing was arranged with Joseph so that they would have time to overtake him. There, the brothers were traveling on donkeys loaded down with grain. The messenger maybe even was on a horse, according to John Gill. I don't know whether they had horses back then or not, but he was not burdened down. So anyway, with the prearrangement and the fact that he wasn't burdened, he caught up with them. Not a problem. Now, when he says, why? The brother said, why does my Lord speak such words as these? The words accusing them of being thieves. Those words must have hit the brothers like a thunderbolt. They're in a great mood, going back. They got Simeon out of jail. Benjamin is back with them, so he didn't get in trouble, and so they can fulfill their vow to Jacob to bring Benjamin back. They got food to get through the famine. Life's a bowl of cherries, and all of a sudden they're being accused of stealing from the number two guy in Egypt. Now, we're not told which one of the brothers is speaking here. I'm assuming it's Judah because he's the spokesman for the brothers now, but whoever it was is not stated. But whoever it was said that they would die if that silver cup was found in one of their sacks. Well, that was a rash vow, especially in light of the fact that on the first trip, there was silver money mysteriously placed in the nine brothers' bags, and that sort of thing might happen again. Now, notice it was just one brother that was to die according to this vow by one of the brothers. If that brother had said, we will all die if somebody has the cup in their bag, that would be too severe a penalty for theft by one of the brothers to make them all die. There's another thing, too, that we need to notice in verse 9. The servant adjusted the offer of punishment in case the silver cup was found. He said, with whomever of your servants it is found, let him die. Excuse me, in verse 10, the servant said, "Now let it also be according to your words." Actually, that was only partially according to their words did the steward agree with the punishment. So not only did one of the brothers moderate the death penalty for all of them to just the death penalty for the guilty party, the steward moderated the punishment on down to, well, we'll let everybody be innocent who doesn't have the silver cup, but the guilty party is not going to die, but he's going to be a slave. So things are getting a little bit less severe, and I suspect that was is not to scare the brothers too badly. That would be sort of cruel if you think about it, especially since the steward knew that when he searched the bags, the silver cup was going to be in Benjamin's bag, and he didn't want to make it look like he had just promised death to Benjamin. That's the last thing he wanted to do. He just wanted to put Benjamin in apparent risk, but not to such risk that it would look like the steward was going back on his promise, and also not to make it look like Benjamin was under a death sentence. That would be really, really bad, in my humble opinion. So we go now to Genesis 44, verses 11 through 13. Then they, that's the brothers, hurried, each man lowered his sack to the ground, and each man opened his sack. He searched, beginning with the oldest and ending with the youngest. That's the steward searched, beginning with the oldest and ending with the youngest. And the cup was found in Benjamin's sack. That was the last sack because Benjamin was the youngest. Then they tore their clothes, and when each man loaded his donkey, they returned to the city. Now the brothers hurried to open their sack because they were quick to show they're innocent because they knew they were innocent. Now, the text doesn't say this here. It doesn't describe what happened completely, because as each man opened his sack, each man would find extra money put at the top of the sack, money that they didn't put there. Just like on the first trip home. Now on the second trip home, they got money added to their sack, which is going to make them look like a thief. So while the steward is looking for that silver cup, he's determining as each brother opens up his sack, aha, so you're a thief too, second brother. Well, I guess we'd start with Reuben. Ah, Reuben, you're a thief. Then Simeon, Reuben, you got some extra money in your sack. Are you a thief? Then Levi, then Judah, and on and on and on it goes, finding money in the sack. And then to top it all off, the silver cup is in Benjamin's sack. So that's quite a dramatic scene there. Now, I'm speculating here. It's kind of strange that the text does not mention the steward finding the money as each sack was opened. So I'm just speculating a little bit here. Maybe the steward gave them a knowing look as the sack was unopened. Well, what's that doing there? You're guilty of money, huh? But let's keep going to find out what I'm really looking for, which is that silver cup. We'll get back to this money later. So in other words, the author just might have focused on the most important part of this story, which is the silver cup theft, alleged theft. Now, it's interesting that the steward searched, beginning with the oldest and going to the youngest. How would he know that? Well, he knew that because he was at the banquet that Joseph had given to the brothers just the night before in the previous chapter, Genesis 43:33. Now they, the brothers, were seated before him, before Joseph, the firstborn according to his birthright and the youngest according to his youth. And the men looked at one another in astonishment. So the steward would have seen that. In fact, Joseph had probably given the steward the age order of the brother so the steward could lay out the plates in that way and seat the brothers according to age order, which of course would astonish them. Oh, is this a coincidence? How does he know who's older than whom? But at any rate, doing it by age order, that steward was heightening the dramatic effect because the brothers, not only are they seeing money in their sacks as the sacks are opened, they're watching the steward doing the opening in birth order, and they're thinking, oh my gosh, what is going on here? And then, of course, that's topped off with finding the cup in Benjamin's sack. Now, let's talk a little bit about how Joseph could have arranged such a scheme, because what it does is it takes Benjamin away from returning home to his old bereaved father and sends Benjamin back to Egypt. And so some people have questioned, how could Joseph tear Benjamin away from the bleeding heart of his old, desolate father? Adam Clark says that this is very difficult to account for. Now, I'm going to read you Clark's solution. To me, it might be a little bit difficult, but I don't think Joseph was meaning to detain Benjamin for that long. A couple more days, what difference does it make? So I don't know why Clark says it's very difficult to account for Joseph's scheme here, but this is what Clark says, quote, "Unless the spirit of prophecy had assured him that this experiment would terminate in the most favorable manner, his conduct in making it cannot well be vindicated. To such prophetic intimation, this conduct has been attributed by learned men, and we may say that this consideration, if it does not untie the knot, at least cuts it. Perhaps it is best to say that in all these things, Joseph acted as he was directed by a providence, under the influence of which he might have been led to do many things which he had not previously designed. In other words, God covered him for the injustice of keeping Benjamin away from his father. I don't think so. I don't think we need to go to that extreme. I think Joseph knew that he knew the brothers were going to come back. He knew that nobody was going to hurt Benjamin. He knew that he was eventually going to restore Benjamin back to Jacob, so just a little bit longer is not going to hurt anything. And we'll see that everything works out well as we continue with the story. Now the brothers, when the cup was found in Benjamin's sack, they tore their clothes. That's the traditional sign of grief. You tear your clothes. Then they return to the city. Now, they were declared innocent by the steward, at least as far as the silver cup. But they weren't returned innocent. They weren't declared innocent because of the money in their sack. So I'm not sure whether the steward would have let them go, but if he had let the brothers go back to Egypt, go back to Canaan to see their father Jacob, the brothers weren't about to do that because they would have to return without Benjamin. And oh my gosh, we remember the uproar that Jacob had raised from fear that Benjamin might not return. We see Reuben speaking to his father in Genesis 42:37. Then Reuben spoke to his father, saying, "You may put my two sons to death if I do not bring him back to you. Put him in my care, and I will return him to you." Now, Jacob didn't take Reuben up on that offer. But then we go to Genesis 43:9, and we see Judah making another offer. "I, Judah myself, will be surety for him. You may hold me responsible for him." He's talking to his father Jacob. "Jacob, you may hold me responsible if Benjamin doesn't come back. If I do not bring him back to you and set him before you, then let me bear the blame before you forever." So to summarize, the brothers are not going back to Canaan without Benjamin. So they went back to Joseph's city, wherever that was. So we go now to Genesis 44, verses 14 and 15. "When Judah and his brothers came to Joseph's house, he, Joseph, was still there, and they fell to the ground before him. Joseph said to them, 'What is this deed that you have done? Do you not know that such a man as I can indeed practice divination?'" Now notice that Judah is singled out here amongst the brothers who are returning to the city. "When Judah and his brothers came," why is that? Because now Judah has taken the role of the spokesman of his brothers, as we've mentioned in a previous audio. Even though he's only the fourth oldest, and to review that, the reason why is Reuben, the oldest, has slept with Bilhah, Jacob's concubine. He's out. Simeon, number two brother, and Levi, number three brother, they had unjustly murdered the Shechemites when the individual Shechem had raped their sister Dinah, and in revenge, they had killed all the Shechemites by getting them to have a circumcision, a hypocritical circumcision. So we've already talked about that story. That knocks out the top three brothers. Judah's number four. So he's in charge now. Joseph was still there. He hadn't gone to work yet, assuming his work was in a different house. I imagine it was. He was waiting for the brothers to come back. When the brothers got back to Joseph's house, they fell to the ground before Joseph. Now, this is the fourth fulfillment of Joseph's dreams. Remember the dreams. All the brothers are going to bow down to Joseph. Genesis 37:7. Joseph says, "For behold, we were binding sheaves." We, meaning Joseph and the brothers, were binding sheaves in the field, and lo, my sheaf rose up and also stood erect, and behold, your sheaves gathered around and bowed down to my sheaf. And the same point is made in his second dream, Genesis 37, verse 9. Now he had still another dream, Joseph did, and related it to his brothers, and said, "Lo, I have had still another dream, and behold, the sun and the moon and the 11 stars were bowing down to me." The 11 stars referring to the brothers, the sun referring to Jacob, and the moon referring to Rachel, because they are the father and mother of the patriarchal tribes of Israel, so all of Israel will bow down to Joseph, but more particularly the 11 stars, that's the brothers. So these brothers are going to bow down to Joseph. This has happened four times. Let's look. This is the fourth time. The brothers fell down to Joseph when they got back. But the first time is in Genesis 42:6, when Joseph's brothers first met Joseph in arriving in Egypt on their first trip to Egypt. Now Joseph was the ruler over the land. He was the one who sold to all the people of the land, and Joseph's brothers came and bowed down to him with their faces to the ground. That's the first bowing down. Second bowing down. This is in Genesis 43:26, when Joseph came home, they brought into the house to him the present which was in their hand and bowed to the ground before him. So this is when they had the big feast with Joseph. They bowed down. That's the second bowing down. And here's the third bowing down. At the end of the same feast, Genesis 43, verse 28, they said, Your servant, our father, is well. He is still alive. They bowed down in homage. I'm assuming that's another bowing down, not the same one. So that's three of them. And in this verse right here, they return after the discovery of the silver cup back to Joseph's house, and they fall down to their face again and bow down to him again. So that dream of God was certainly brought to pass. Now, in verse 15, Joseph said, "Hey, you guys, don't you know that such a man as I can indeed practice divination? Oh, maybe he's guilty of divination using that silver cup." Well, no, we don't need to rescue Joseph from moral blame because he was a diviner, because he had a silver cup of divination. That's all a part of his ruse. And besides, it's not even necessary to use the stolen cup as a pretext for saying that Joseph was a diviner, because Joseph was already famous for being able to interpret dreams, so he could maybe not even be referring to that cup of divination. He's just saying, "Don't you know my reputation? That's why I'm here number two in Egypt, because I interpreted those two dreams of Pharaoh about the 7 years of plenty and the 7 years of famine. So I know where my silver cups are." He's pulling out all the stops to frighten the stew out of his brothers. And this idea of, "Don't you know, guys, that I can practice divination?" That's really an a fortiori statement. Even an ordinary person would figure out that the guest who had just left had stole the silver cup. They just had a meal there the night before. The silver cup's missing the next day. Well, who likely stole it? You don't need to be a prophet to figure that out. So the brothers are looking to be in bad shape. The circumstantial evidence condemns them. The number two man in all of Egypt is condemning them, the man who has the power to interpret dreams. They're screwed. We go now to verse 16, Genesis 44. So Judah said, "What can we say to my Lord?" Again, Judah is the spokesman for the brothers now. "What can we say to my Lord? What can we speak? And how can we justify ourselves? God has found out the iniquity of your servants." Ooh, guilty conscience speaking there. "God has found out the iniquity of your servants. Behold, we are my Lord's slaves, both we and the one in whose possession the cup has been found." Apparently, the guilty conscience, as I said, of Judah and the brothers are starting to grab a hold of them. They realize that God or fate or whatever they believed in was catching them up for their wicked past when they sold their brother into slavery to certain death. Now, Judah says, "God has found out the iniquity of your servants." Now, the problem there is that there was no iniquity of the servants in the present situation. They had not stolen that cup. So why would Judah admit to guilt when the brothers hadn't actually stolen the cup? Well, here's some possible solutions to that. I've got three suggestions. Suggestion number one, Judah is referring to the guilt of having stolen and sold Joseph, the guilt of the brothers in doing that. It's obvious they are stricken in their conscience about that, because in Genesis 42, in our previous chapter, we read this, verses 21 and 22. "Then they," the brothers, "said to one another, 'Truly we are guilty concerning our brother, because we saw the distress of his soul when he pleaded with us, yet we would not listen. Therefore, this distress has come upon us.'" So they already realize that they're guilty for selling Joseph into slavery, and they say the reason we're screwed over here, that we're accused of being spies and thieves, is because we sold Joseph into slavery. Reuben answered that the brothers talking there about their guilt. He said, "Did I not tell you, do not sin against the boy, and you would not listen? Now comes the reckoning for his blood." Ah, they're expecting judgment to come on their heads. And so when they get caught for this silver cup and also the money being stolen again, they are interpreting that as judgment for their sin. And that could very well be what Judah is referring to when Judah says, "God has found out the iniquity of your servants." But there's another option. Maybe Judah is saying, "Look, we were caught so red-handed, we have no choice to but confess, even though we don't really believe we're guilty in this particular incident." They knew they were innocent, actually. But hey, what's the point? The evidence is all there. They're cooked. So he just went ahead and confessed, trying to get a light sentence. That's option number two. Here's option number three from Adam Clark. The 11 brothers thought that Benjamin had actually stolen the cup. Benjamin might have been drinking from the cup the night before, because Benjamin was specially honored at that feast. Benjamin might have had the most honorable cup, like he had the most honorable portion of food, that fivefold portion of food. And so the brothers might have said, "Well, you know, he stole the cup. We're guilty, and we're going to share that guilt with our brothers." Well, those are three interesting views. I think the first solution is the best, that they're actually referring to the guilt of having stolen and sold Joseph as a slave, is what the iniquity they're talking about. And so Judah's saying, "Okay, we'll take our punishment for that, even if we didn't steal the silver cup." And our punishment is, we are the Lord's, your Lord's, we are my Lord's slaves, both we and the one in whose possession the cup had been found. In other words, the 10 brothers plus Benjamin are slaves. Now, in verse 16, the short verses, what can we say? What can we speak? How can we justify ourselves? Those short, broken sentences show the emotion that that verse should be read with. They are grief-stricken. Now, notice that Judah is, by offering slavery to Joseph, slavery of the 11 brothers, Judah is asking for a stricter sentence than the steward offered. Remember, the steward said, look, when he caught up with him on the road, he said, look, I'll let all the brothers who didn't steal the cup go free, but the one who stole the cup, he's going to be a slave. So that was just slavery for one, but now Judah's offering slavery for all. Now, why did he do that? This is my speculation. I couldn't find any commentator that opined on this issue. Perhaps Judah is referring to the fact that the non-cup-holding brothers had unexplained money in their sacks, and they're saying, well, you got us for that, so make us slaves for that. Or it could be he's thinking, we're all facing the death penalty here for what we've done. And that, in ancient times, yes, sir, that's capital offense, I'm sure, stealing from the viceroy, the vizier. And so what Judah is doing, according to this theory, is that Judah is asking for jail time in order to avoid the death penalty. But at any rate, he did ask for a stricter sentence, either because of his guilt-stricken conscience or because he's pragmatically trying to get out of getting killed. But for whatever reason, he offers a stricter sentence on the brothers than the steward actually said was going to come. We go to verse 17, Genesis 44. But he said, that is Joseph, far be it from me to do this. Far be it from me to make all of you slaves. The man in whose possession the cup has been found, he shall be my slave. But as for you, go in peace, go up in peace to your father. Of course, the man in whose possession the cup had been found, that was Benjamin. Now, why did Joseph do that? Well, ostensibly, it shows that he's just. He says, look, you guys didn't steal the cup. I'm going to let you go. Of course, he's still got the problem of the money in the sack. I don't know. Somehow that's not mentioned in this account. But at any rate, Joseph is either showing that he's just or that he's merciful and not going to hold him to account for that money. He's just only going to punish the guilty, not the innocent. Well, that's ostensibly. It shows that he's just to everybody watching. But his real purpose was to deprive the brothers of Benjamin, to test them. In other words, he's going to take Benjamin away from the brothers to see if the brothers try to get him back, as opposed to when they sold Joseph into slavery to see if they've reformed any, and now they're going to try to protect one of their brothers from being a slave. He set the situation up perfectly. He would now see whether the brothers would treat Benjamin like they treated him, like they treated Joseph. This is, again, speculation. This text doesn't actually say this. It's speculating as to Joseph's motives. But I wonder how much of a test this really was. The brothers were under the gun to keep Benjamin alive. Their father said to Judah, I'm going to hold you accountable. You don't bring Benjamin back. It would kill Jacob if they came back and said, we don't have Benjamin. So their efforts to save Benjamin are motivated by self-interest as much as a repentant heart, in my opinion. Now, of course, Joseph might not have known what Jacob had said concerning Benjamin, but I bet it seems to me he might have divined it, might have guessed that Jacob would really be upset if the brothers came back without Benjamin. And so he must have realized there was great external pressure on them to bring Benjamin back. And so that when he looks to see if they treat Benjamin right, and they do try to save Benjamin from slavery or from death, that would show Joseph that the brothers have repented. It's not quite as clear as it might be. Let's put it that way. But at any rate, he is going to see the brothers do what they can to save Benjamin from slavery, because we hear this impassioned plea from Judah in the next 17 verses, which I'm going to read to you all at once, because it's mainly a rehash of what Jacob has already said to Judah, and we've talked about that in the last chapter. And so Joseph is going to see how much they want to keep Benjamin out of slavery. And by seeing this, Joseph is going to know that the brothers have repented. So we start now in verse 18. We'll go to verse 34 in Genesis 44. Then Judah approached Joseph, and said, O my Lord, may your servant please speak a word in my Lord's ears, and do not be angry with your servant, for you are equal to Pharaoh. I'm going to interpret this as I go instead of waiting until the end. You are equal to Pharaoh. Actually, that's not really true. Joseph was number two, so that's not reality. That's flattery, really. You're equal to Pharaoh. My Lord asked his servant, saying, have you a father or a brother? This is in a previous chapter. We talked about this. Joseph is inquiring of them when they said they were sons of one father. We said to my Lord, we have an old father and a little child of his old age. Now, how old was Jacob at this time? 130 years old. We know that from Genesis 47:9. So Jacob said to Pharaoh, this is when Jacob came down to Egypt, the years of my sojourning are 130. Few and unpleasant have been the years of my life, nor have they attained the years that my fathers lived during the days of their sojourning. Jacob's a little bit depressed. His life was really not a very happy life, as opposed to Abraham or Isaac's. But at any rate, he's 130 years old. So the children say, so Judah says to Joseph, we have an old father, 130 years, and a little child of his old age. That would be Benjamin, born to Rachel. Now his brother is dead. That's referring to Joseph. So he alone is left of his mother, and his father loves him. Now his brother is dead. They didn't mention how that happened. Judah did mention the reason he's dead is because they sold him into slavery, allegedly dead. He actually wasn't, but they thought he was. Now his brother is dead, so he alone is left of his mother. That's his mother, Rachel, and his father loves him. Remember, Benjamin and Joseph were the two blood brothers, full blood brothers of Jacob and Rachel, had common father and common mother. They weren't half brothers. They were full brothers. Then you said to your servants, you, Joseph, said to your servants, bring him, bring Benjamin down to me, bring Benjamin down to Joseph, that I may set my eyes on him. But we said to my Lord, the lad cannot leave his father, for if he should leave his father would die. You said to your servants, however, unless your youngest brother comes down with you, you will not see my face again. Now, Joseph saying that threat to the brothers, you're not going to see my face again if I don't see Benjamin, that's actually not directly related in the text, but it can be inferred because in Genesis 43:3, Judah spoke to Jacob, his father. This is when they had come back from their first trip and they're back in Canaan. And Judah said, the man solemnly warned us, you shall not see my face unless your brother is with you. So Joseph said that. And again, we have this account here. So you said, Joseph, you will not see my face again unless you bring Benjamin back. Verse 24, Genesis 44. Thus it came about when we went up to your servant, my father, we told him the words of my Lord. Our father said, go back, buy us a little food. But we said, we cannot go down. If our youngest brother is with us, then we will go down. For we cannot see the man's face unless our youngest brother is with us. Your servant, my father, said to us, you know that my wife bore me two sons. Now, this is the brothers relating what Jacob was saying to the brothers on their way to Egypt. You know that my wife, that's Rachel, bore me two sons, that's Benjamin and Joseph. And the one went out from me, and I said, surely he is torn in pieces. That, of course, is what Jacob thought had happened to Joseph because his sons deceived him about what actually happened to him. He was sold into slavery, but they said, nah, here's his coat of many colors. It's covered with blood. A wild beast got him. Jacob continues telling the sons, I have not seen him since. And of course, the sons are relating this back to Joseph. And continuing in verse 9, Jacob's speech to his sons, if you take this one also from me, take Benjamin from me, and harm befalls him, you will bring my gray hair down to Sheol in sorrow. That's just that Hebrew way of saying I'm going to die in pain. Gray hair because he's old. Sheol means grave in Hebrew. Now therefore, when I come to your servant, my father, notice how he calls Jacob the servant, because Jacob now, in the dream, he was the son, and now he's the servant of Joseph. When I come to your servant, my father, and the lad is not with us, lad is, might be a questionable translation, he's over 30 years old, 30 plus years, as John Gill says, and the lad is not with us, since his life is bound up in the lad's life, when he sees that the lad is not with us, he will die. Thus your servants will bring the gray hair of your servant, our father, down to Sheol in sorrow. For your servant became surety for the lad to my father, saying, this is Judah talking, he's a surety for the boy coming back, Benjamin coming back. Judah says this, if I do not bring him back to you, then let me bear the blame before my father forever. Now, therefore, please let your servant remain instead of the lad a slave to my lord, and let the lad go up with his brother. So Judah's saying, hey, let Benjamin go, I'll take his place. I'll be the slave instead of Benjamin. Reuben continues in verse 34. Excuse me, not Reuben, Judah. For how shall I go up to my father if the lad is not with me, for fear that I see the evil that would overtake my father? And of course, the evil would be the fact that his father would be in misery. In fact, the NIV translates it as misery. Now, we get a glimpse of Jacob's feeling for his sons when we look at how he reacted when he thought that Jacob had been killed by a wild beast, Genesis 37:34-35. So Jacob tore his clothes and put sackcloth on his loins and mourned for his son many days. Then all his sons and all his daughters arose to comfort him, but he refused to be comforted. And he said, surely I will go down to Sheol in mourning for my son. So his father wept for him. Now let's talk a little bit about this transaction between Judah and Benjamin. Judah saying, I will become a slave instead of Benjamin. Some people say that shows that Judah is a type of Christ, giving himself for somebody else, saving somebody else's life. An innocent man bearing the punishment for a guilty man. That does sound like what Jesus did for us. Jameson Fawcett Brown says this, quote, it may well be imagined that Benjamin, who stood there speechless like a victim about to be laid on the altar, when he heard the magnanimous offer of Judah to submit to slavery for his ransom, would be bound by a lifelong gratitude to his generous brother, a tie that seems to have become hereditary in his tribe. Well, if you think about it, on the map of Israel, you have Judah and Benjamin. They're the only two tribes in the southern kingdom of Judah. When the northern 10 tribes were taken off 722 BC, you got two tribes left. That was Judah and Benjamin. They were close then. In fact, Jerusalem was situated on the boundary line between the two tribes. Now, Judah's willingness to become a slave for Benjamin made amends for his part in selling Joseph. We read in Genesis 37, verses 26 and 27, Judah said to his brothers, what profit is it for us to kill our brother and cover up his blood? Come, and let us sell him to the Ishmaelites and not lay our hands on him, for he is our brother, our own flesh, and his brothers listened to him. Well, now, I don't know if it's really proper to say that Judah is extraordinarily guilty for his part in selling Joseph, because Judah's efforts to enslave Joseph were aimed at delivering Joseph from death. He says, Leah, we'll sell him, but it's better than killing him. So Judah's trying to protect Benjamin back then. And he was in a situation where the brothers are going to sell him anyway, no matter what he did. So I'm not really sure he's trying to make amends. He's just saying, I love my brother. I don't want him to go back to Jacob. Now, this is what Adam Clark says about Judah's speech here to Joseph. Quote, no paraphrase can heighten the effect of Judah's address to Joseph. To add would be to diminish its excellence. To attempt to explain would be to obscure its beauties. To clothe the ideas in other language than that of Judah and his translators in our Bible would ruin its energy and destroy its influence. It is perhaps one of the most tender, affecting pieces of natural oratory ever spoken or wept aloud. It is one of the most affecting pieces of natural oratory ever spoken or penned, and we need not wonder to find that when Joseph heard it, he could not refrain himself, but wept aloud. His soul must have been insensible beyond what is common to human nature, had he not immediately yielded to a speech so delicately tender and so powerfully impressive. We cannot but deplore the unnatural and unscientific division of the narrative in our common Bibles, which obliges us to have recourse to another chapter in order to witness the effects which this speech produced on the heart of Joseph. Well, we'll leave it there. We will have recourse to another chapter in our next audio, which will be chapter 45, and we'll see Joseph crying like a baby as he is reconciled to his brothers and eventually to his father Jacob. So that's our next chapter, verses 1 through 28. I'll do the whole chapter. I hope you stay tuned for that chapter, and I hope you enjoyed this one.